that the Ahl Bayt, they say, yeah, they might be halal, but they should not be done. And sometimes there are fun things that we do, but that are actually considered to be haram. So as a believer, as a mu'min, I need to educate myself to know what is halal, what is haram, what is mustahab, recommended, and what is makruh, not recommended, right? As a mu'min, I need to know these things because sometimes I could indulge something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not like, if not hate, you know? So we have to be aware of these things. And the Ahl Bayt alayhim salamullah, they haven't left anything, and they haven't left any stones unturned in this regard, mind you. So if we dig deep, and no, actually you don't need to dig deep, you just need to open Google and type in acts that are makruh, and you get a list of them. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, for example, in a hadith, he says, in a long hadith, he says, وَأَمَّا الَّتِي مِنْ أَخْلَاقِ قَوْمِ لُوطِ. As for the things that was the traits of Qawm Lut. And Qawm Lut, we know what they did. And the homosexuality they committed. And these days, the people of Lut increasing in our time more than any other time in history of mankind. He says, amongst the traits that these people used to do are these. Which means, in return, me and you, we need to avoid these things. One, he says, فَالْجَلَاهُقُ وَهُوَ الْبُنْدُقُ. قوم لوط, they used to make a small bow, like a very tiny bow, and they used to play with it. Now, how do they used to play with it? I did not find enough information myself on this regard, but maybe there is that I have not found out. But they would use that small ball to play with, whether they throw it inside a hole, or it's like a marble, I don't know. But in our time, we have so many balls that people use, soccer ball, we have basketball, we have so many balls that we're using. We have to be very careful that it's not in relation to this. So he said they used to use balls to play with, just to waste time. Okay, now if it's done for another purpose, that's another story for another day. And he says, وَمَلْغُ الْعِلْكِ. They just chew for a long time for no reason. Now, when I want to chew, sometimes I want to have a bit of flavor in my mouth or change the breath, the smell in my mouth. But just to keep chewing for the sake of chewing, I don't think that has a reason. This was one of the methods and the akhlaq of the people of Lut. We need to avoid. Hold that thought. Let's just take a short break and then we come back.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرون درختکاری اینجا کم ثواب داره دعا هم داره ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که این رو گفته بارم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Keys of Life. The last thing we stopped at is ومضغ العلك, chewing. Now, I said the idea of a chewing or chewing gum is that when I put it in my mouth, I need to change my breath, because some of these chewing gums have mint or a flavor. I get the sugar rush out of it. and it should last maximum 3, 4, 5 minutes. I keep chewing for an hour or so. Why? For what reason? You're making your gums and you're making your teeth and your whole jaw tired. For what reason? Actually, even scientifically proven that chewing gums are very bad for the health. So the Imam says one of the things that the people of Lut used to do is that you were chewing all the time. The Imam says this is a makruh act. Not haram. Huh? It's not forbidden. Something not recommended. Don't do it. وَإِرْخَاءِ الْإِزَارِ. So back in the day, they used to put things on their backs and walk. They used to make it long and big enough to, they make it very loose, and they make the pants very loose as well. And alhamdulillah, we don't have that these days, but it was more common in the 90s where people have very loose pants. And he says, وَحَلُّ الْأَزْرَارِ مِنَ الْقِبَاءِ وَالْقَمِيسِ. And he says, opening the buttons when it comes to the shirts. So some people, like now, it became fashion that the first three buttons in the chest, they are open. This was the act of the people of Lut, one of the things that they used to do. So me and you, we don't need to do these things. Now, chess seemed to be like a global game, a game of thinking, a game of concentration. Some of the ulama say it's makruh. Some ulama say it's only allowed if it's done for a certain purpose. So obviously, you need to refer to your marja in this regard. So this is one of the things. Or an-nard, another game that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions in the Quran and falls under the category of innama al-khamru wal-maysuru wal-ansabi wal-alzam rijsum min amal shaitan fashtubu. That, gambling and alcohol and all these things that used for tools of gambling are in fact acts of shaitan. One needs to avoid. So for example, when we play, sometimes we play with dominoes, sometimes we play with chess, sometimes we play with dices. Some of these games, and especially the ones that I mentioned, most of the ulama, most of the scholars either say it's haram, it's makruh, or should be done with certain intentions, with certain purposes. So I can't give you a verdict on any of these, but you have to do what? You have to go search for yourself and read for yourself. And when it comes to qimar, when it comes to cards, because cards also another game that we do as entertainment. Now, also when it comes to cards, we have a hadith from Imam Rida alayhi salam. He says, وَأَعْلَمْ يَرْحَمُكَ اللَّهُ إِنَّ اللَّهَ تَبَارَكَ وَتَعَالَى نَهَا عَنْ جَمِيعَ الْقِمَارِ. Allah has forbade all sorts of gambling, whether it is card, whether it is any form of gambling. وَأَمَرَ الْعِبَادِ بِالْإِجْتِنَابِ مِنْهَا وَسَمَّهَا رِجْسًا. And Allah has told the people to stay away from it, and he said it is impurity. Whatever game that we do or we want to play for the sake of our fun, we have to be sure that it is not haram, which means go back to the masail of the maraja and read about it. We leave it here and we will continue in other episodes. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
The Was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say,
I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasis, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the rules of najasa or impure substances based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Tawid, what is the degree of moisture or wetness that, causes najasa or impurity, the ritual impurity, spreading from one object to another?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The criterion for transmitting moisture is that the wetness should spread from a wet body to another body, or from a wet object to another object, when they contact each other. When we know for sure that there is moisture that transfers to another object, and we are certain that the things have come into contact with each other, then we should actually consider the thing to be impure. It is important that we should be certain about it. If we are not certain, or if we are not sure that any moisture, any wet or and impure moisture has transferred to the second object, then we cannot consider it as impure. And it's also important that we understand that a dry najis object does not make another dry object impure. Mm-hmm. For example, if you touch a dry drop of blood, which is essentially impure, of course, it does not make your hand impure. So there are people who believe that, okay, if you touch a dog or a pig or something, it will make your hand impure. But that is not the case, because a dry thing, even though it is essentially impure, will not make you impure.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, there is another one which, in fact, we all of us are subject to on a day-to-day basis these sure. days, you know, and that's about the clothes. Basically, we give our clothes sometimes to the laundry houses, right, or the dry cleaners to either clean them, wash them, you know, and do the ironing for us.
Sure.
Right? So as far as the purity is concerned, what's the rule or what's the criterion for us to know? And sometimes we know that in the Muslim countries, we are dealing with religious minorities. They also give their laundries to these dry cleaners, these centers, for their clothes to be clean, you know? And what about the other non-Islamic countries? Because as a Muslim, when you live in the non-Muslim or non-Islamic countries, right? So there are lots of other sects coming to these centers to get their clothes clean. So what's the rule?
Well, basically, clothes given to laundries and dry cleaners, if they were not najis in the very first place, mm-hmm. they are considered pure, and they're coming into contact with the clothes of the minorities from the people of the book, from Ahlul Kitab, mm-hmm. does not make your clothes impure. And the same is the case with the clothes of people who do not belong to any Abrahamic religions. Mm-hmm. They are atheists or other minorities, let's say. And since you do not know that their clothes are impure, and it's very much likely, though, that their clothes might be impure, mm-hmm. but you have no knowledge, and you are not sure that their clothes are impure. So if you get your clothes washed by the laundry service and you are still not sure whether your clothes are pure or impure, then according to Islamic law, you have to consider your clothes as pure.
Mm-hmm,
and you don't have to investigate, because actually a lack of knowledge is a blessing in disguise in this mm-hmm. in this context
scenario,
in this in this scenario.
Yeah, thank you very much, Sheikh Shavit. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawheed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the rules of impure substances based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Tawheed. Sheikh Tawheed, do the clothes washed in a fully automatic washing machine as a home appliance become pure or what? The mode of functioning, what about this? The mode of functioning of this machine is as follows. Initially, when the clothes are washed in it with detergent, some water and foam of the detergent spreads, right, on the glass door of the machine and the rubber surrounding it. After that, the used water is drawn while the foam of the detergent remains on the glass door and the rubber surrounding it. And at later stages, the machine washes the clothes thrice with qalil water, little water, and then the used water is driven out. So sure. Would you please shed some light on this issue and explain whether the clothes washed in this way are pure or not?
Well, most of the washing machines are automatic in the sense that the machines are connected to the tap water, and that tap water is connected to cool water. And therefore, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, if the clothes, if the essential najasa or impurity is removed, okay?
Yes.
And then the clothes are placed inside the washing machine, and the washing machine is turned on. Since the washing machine is connected to cool water, the clothes which come into contact with the with that water become pure. And that's the Sharia law. That's the Sharia position held not only by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, but also other scholars, because something impure coming into contact with cool water becomes pure. Now, in the event that the washing machine is not connected to cool water, mm-hmm. and because we have some kinds of washing machine that are filled with water, and then the water is drained out, and then again it's filled with water, that's called this kind of, it's a kind of drum actually, with which washes the, you know, the clothes inside. So in the event that it's not connected to cool water, then if it is washed twice with qalil water, with little water, then again the clothes washed inside become pure, and they are they can be used for praying and anything which requires tahara.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. You know, we all know that when we wash our clothes, sometimes the water in that special container can drop out, all right?
Yes.
And either by falling on the ground, or sometimes it is splashed on our clothes.
Yeah.
So does that make our clothes impure?
Well, it's very much clear, according to the scholars. They have said on different occasions and under differing headings related to tahara, that the water which comes out of the clothes which are being washed, and which is of course there is a special Arabic word which I do not want to use,
mm-hmm.
that water is actually is pure.
Mm-hmm.
So generally speaking, if water is poured on a pure spot or ground, the drops that splash from it are also pure. Okay, the drops are also. And if we doubt whether that place is pure or najis, the splash drops are ruled to be pure as well. So in the event that we are not certain and we have doubt, again, the splash drops are considered to be pure.
So if we are certain that some clothes that are put into that container to be washed are najis, then what?
If you're certain.
Yes.
You know, it depends. If, for example, the it is washed with cool water, the drops that fall off are pure, definitely pure.
Yes.
But if there's qalil water,
yes,
and it is the first time, because when it comes to qalil water, you have to wash the impure thing twice. If it is washed for the first time and there's very little quantity of water, the mm-hmm. water which drops on the floor,
yes,
is impure. Uh-huh, and if it's washed for the second time and then you squeeze it and make sure that there's no water left inside,
yes,
so that water is pure.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, and thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the crew, here we say Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
The battle within.
Here is to all the ones I love. I'm sorry I could not take it anymore, so it is time for me to go where the sun is always sunny and the grass is always green and the flowers smell like honey. Levi left us a letter. My mother found it. It, to me, it's the most precious gift that he gave me. When my son was over there after Operation Anaconda, they had to clean up landmines that were left around Bagram Air Base and the area for troops to come. And they stopped to take a break. And a young Afghan girl came over and asked for a bottle of water. My son threw it to her. It hit the ground, and when she stepped forward to pick the bottle of water up, she stepped on a landmine that they had missed, and it killed her. My son ran and was holding her body, what was left of her, rocking her.
Levi Derby was born in Cisna Park, Illinois, on May 13, 1981. He joined the Army in 2001 and was deployed to Afghanistan 6 months later.
I was very proud. It was something that my mother and I had encouraged him for quite some time. My father having served during World War II, mm-hmm. My great-grandfather was the private guard to Kaiser Wilhelm in Germany. At six generations or more in my family has served. So I was very pleased that he had decided to serve his country. He came home and all he had was a dead stare out of his eyes. He was like the walking dead. Anger, you could see anger in him, in a coldness. The happy son that I had known that loved life so much and loved children and animals now would just seem like this shell of a person. Mm-hmm. When he first came home, he was not home long when he was told that he would be shipping off to Iraq. and he could not bear to go into war again. It was something he said he would never do again. He had told me when he came home that he had killed and he would never ever kill again. He just
Judy realized that her son was going AWOL and convinced him to speak to the base chaplain. Levi was not feeling capable of returning to war and agreed to an other than honorable discharge. Therefore, he was denied medical and mental health benefits of any kind by the Army.
He served honorably. I have it in record. I contested his discharge several times. And the last time I contested it, they agreed that he had served honorably. He had went over as a PV2 and came back as an E3. It was promoted while he was there. Because of his illness that was a result from the war, I believe he should have been given a medical discharge.
Levi was becoming more isolated, not taking care of himself or working and having recurring nightmares about his experience at war. He and his family realized that he was in need of inpatient health treatment and decided that he would go to a hospital in Kankakee. Aware of the high cost of treatment and his lack of health care coverage, when Levi and his grandmother were halfway to the hospital, he asked her to turn back.
She drove him home, and my son had an IROC that he had raced, and he had pulled the engine out of the car about a year earlier, and it hung on the chain hoist. He asked his grandma to help him take the engine off the chain hoist. And she did. She went to church. He tried again to call his counselor on the suicide hotline number. And he had told her that he had gotten almost to the hospital, but not today. And she said, well, what about tomorrow? And he said, maybe tomorrow, but everything's going to be okay. And then he came over here and he wrote his letter telling us goodbye. And he went to my dad's garage and he hung himself on the same chain hoist that my dad had swung him on in a car tire when he was a little boy. And he had felt betrayed by our government, his family, his friends. And he hung himself in my dad's garage. And Mom came home from church and opened up the garage door to find my son. I think he could still be here today had he been given the proper treatment.
Every day, 22 veterans take their own lives. As shocking as the number is, it is actually higher if you count men and women such as Levi Derbys. Veterans are killing themselves at more than double the rate of the civilian population, with about 49,000 taking their own lives between 2005 and 2011. The question is, why has suicide become such an epidemic? Adrian served as a captain in the Army Infantry and spent 25 months in Afghanistan over two combat deployments. He now works as a journalist, writing investigative articles for the New York Times concerning PTSD and the high cost of war.
The veterans that are most at risk for PTSD, based on my experience, would be those veterans that participated directly in combat operations. I don't think that's even a risk. I think that's probably a direct correlation. I think if you participate in combat operations, then there's almost a one-to-one correlation with you experiencing some amount of PTSD.
One in
in five veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan has been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, also known as PTSD.
Yeah, PTSD is a psychiatric disease or disorder that was defined in the early 80s, 1980s, by the American Psychiatric Association, although it was known for many, many years, actually.
Dr. Yuval Nuria, Director of Trauma at PTSD at the New York State Psychiatric Institute and Professor of Clinical Psychology at Columbia University Medical Center, runs one of the country's leading trauma programs working with PTSD recovery.
It's comprised of a number of symptom clusters that mainly includes reliving of the trauma. And here's the idea that patient with PTSD is thinking and feeling and recalling, you know, aspects of trauma in an involuntary way again and again. The second cluster is a cluster of actually trying to be removed from the trauma. So because of the, you know, memories of the traumas and rethinking about the trauma is kind of activates a lot of anxiety avoidance, is a key component of PTSD. And that's why, you know, PTSD patients tend to be removed from society, to be alone, to be lonely, and to be avoidant of any reminders that can be associated with the trauma memories.
You're lying, right, man?
I ain't lying. Why would I lie about something like that?
2-6. Where'd he get hit? I gotta
see. Don't look at him.
A detailed study by the Army Surgeon General in 2008 found that 3/4 of young male troops saw someone seriously injured or killed. More than half were attacked or ambushed, and 88% received incoming fire. These traumatic memories tend to replay themselves over and over in these soldiers' minds. As with Levi Derby, the image of the young Afghan girl and the landmine was something he told his mother that he re-experienced on a daily basis. The constant stress of being in a war zone creates illness. These people witness things that disrupt their sense of inner security, what is right and wrong, creating tremendous inner conflict.
In the military, there is the military's story, and that is the story that you are allowed to tell to yourself, to your friends, to your family, and to your fellow, you know, people in the infantry or wherever else. There is, this is what happened, this is what it says on the piece of paper, and that's the way it is. And it's tough to live that reality out in a lot of different ways. I had ideas about what, you know, what PTSD was probably going to be like for me. But what it came down to was actually a very innocuous event. They were attacking us, or we were trying to help people, and bad things happened, but they were in the context of a greater logic. That one moment when I was in a field and people were shooting at me, and I decided to run for cover, not forward, but backwards, because the cover was closer to me backwards, and I didn't want to get shot. I still deal with in the present moment. Now I still check the locks, you know, if I'm in a room, if I'm in a hotel room, if I'm in my apartment, I will make sure that the windows are closed, and I will make sure that the door is locked every day. A lot of it was just revolved around, you know, not drinking as much and taking myself more seriously, establishing routines, and writing and storytelling, which is something that I hadn't made a lot of space for. But there isn't a lot of space for storytelling in the military. There's a lot of space for storytelling afterwards, which is probably why so many of the best writers of the 20th century tended to be veterans of World War I and World War II and Vietnam.
Tonight, I can announce that over the next year, another 34,000 American troops will come home from Afghanistan. This drawdown will continue, and by the end of next year, our war in Afghanistan will be over.
Number one, absolute number one, when they take women and men and they send them into a combat zone, when they come back home, their immediate family needs to be brought in, and they need to be given contact points that they can go to. They need to be given information. They need to be trained what to look for. They need to be given the help, because they're the number one help that's going to help that person more than anybody else is their family. I believe that the soldiers need to be hooked up with veterans from other wars so that they have a safe place to go to talk to, someone else that can understand, that's seen the elephant, as the expression goes. The family definitely needs to be involved. They're their first line of defense, and they're not educating them enough for them to be able to help. My personal feeling, if you've done once, you shouldn't have to go back again.
The government offers a wide array of mental health services, including mental health assessments and testing, medications, psychotherapy and family therapy, and residential or inpatient care programs. However, if you are not entitled to these benefits because of an other than honorable discharge, the cost is prohibitive, leaving them with little or no options, as in the case of Levi Derby. Inpatient mental health hospitalization costs an average of about $2,000 per day. You need a minimum of a 2-week stay, ideally a 4-week stay, which costs between $14,000 and $30,000. This great expense is cost prohibitive for most American families unless the government can step in and cover this cost.
I think that's really very unfortunate. In fact, the main barrier, I think, for treatment currently is not so much the knowledge, the effectiveness of the treatment, the availability of trained clinicians. It's really about being able to mobilize those young adults who are coming back from the wars and give them a sense that there is hope out there. It's so unfortunate, you know. There is a lot of funding coming from federal government and private foundations to war veterans treatment centers. And what you see, unfortunately, is that clinicians are available, treatments are available for those patients, but still patients are not coming to this treatment.
When he first came home, they had him on pills to sleep, pills to deal with the nightmares, pills for the anxiety attacks. He always had a prescription for lorazepam for the anxiety attacks. Then the doctor that was treating him in Watsika said that his PTSD was so severe that he couldn't tell for certain that he also didn't suffer from bipolar disorder. And they started trying to treat him with medication for that. And so many of the medications they tried, he ended up having allergic reactions to them. My son also possibly had traumatic brain injury that was never diagnosed. From the time he had come back to the time he died, sometimes blood would trickle out of his ear and down his neck. Then I took the sheets off of his bed. After his death, there were blood stains on the bed from his ears having bled while he was sleeping.
The efficacy of current treatment is modest, is not as great and as effective as we would like them to be. And this is why there is a lot of research now on working on innovative treatments, treatments that are informed by neuroscience research and treatments that can target directly dysfunctional processes, neural processes. Nevertheless, among the available treatments, I would say that prolonged exposure is the most effective treatment. That treatment involves a gradual process in which we ask patients to recall and memorize different aspects of the traumatic experience again and again until they are comfortable with their experience, until the experience is not reactivate the remarkable anxiety that was associated with the trauma initially. This is a way in which patients are able to gradually get to terms with what happened to them.
So this is why we walk tonight. We're ensuring that suicide doesn't continue to take the lives of our loved ones, our friends, our classmates, our co-workers, or the lives of those in the military and our veterans.
Hope will only come now when we physically defy the violence of the state. All who resist, all who are here today, keep hope alive. All who succumb to fear, despair, and apathy become an enemy of hope. They become, in their passivity, agents of injustice. If the enemies of hope are finally victorious in this nation, the poison of violence will become not only the language of power, but the language of opposition. And those who resist here today with nonviolence are the last thin line of defense between a civil society and its disintegration.
We say get back! We say fight back!
We send them back over and over and over. No person can handle that. You see things in war that you can't unlive it. You can't unremember it. It's there with you forever. And then to make them go back multiple times is way too much. No human can handle that.
Well, I think that assessment before and after deployment is key. And I think they do that. Now, the question is what happened with a soldier that is, you know, coming back home. And the need for treatment is not only in the immediate, you know, point after redeployment. It's really when those people are spending time at home, coming to terms with what happened to them.
The only way to really minimize PTSD amongst military veterans is to not go to war. And war is a trauma factory. So if it's worth it to us to go to war, then we know that part of that calculus, part of that cost, that human cost, is going to be the suffering of the soldiers that go to war. And I don't know if the most recent wars were probably worth the cost and human suffering.
According to the Department of Veterans Affairs, every 65 minutes, a military veteran commits suicide. In 2012, more U.S. soldiers killed themselves than died in combat. Treatment for Iraq and Afghanistan vets suffering from PTSD has cost more than $2 billion so far. Multiple redeployments into war zones have not only had unprecedented financial cost for the U.S. government, but incalculable mental and emotional costs on America's men and women in uniform and their families. A clear indication that the greatest casualties of war are seldom on the battlefield.
Thank you.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
Self-purification is the most significant factor
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, we're welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Farahzad. Stay tuned.
گفتارمون با عملمون توأم باشه یعنی اگر چیزی که وعده‌ای که میدم آقا من 6 ماه اینو تحویل میدم یک سال تحویل میدم
Our words and actions must be in harmony with each other. If we make a promise or sign a contract, we must do it on the given time. In the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Saf, Ayah 2, we read, O you who have faith, why do you say what you do not do? Based on this ayah, we must not make a promise that we cannot abide by. This case includes making the smallest promises even to children or family members.
قولوا للناس حسنا چقدر آیه قشنگی سوره مبارکه بقره است
In a part of ayah 83 of surah al-baqarah we read do good to your parents relatives orphans and the needy and speak kindly to people In this ayah we are recommended to speak kindly to people around speaking kindly and beautifully to the people who are around us will attract them. Also, kind words can solve many problems in the society. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Farahzad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
An-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawda'a al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaw.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was this beautiful fountainhead of wisdom and knowledge. He had complete mastery over all of the Islamic sciences, but he was also a master upon the non-Islamic sciences. He was the honorable direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. And His Eminence Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the 10th divinely appointed Imam, the 10th divinely appointed successor, and the 10th divinely appointed trustee of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. During the imama of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, the Abbasid Caliph Mutawakkil had the most bitter enmity against Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, and this was due to the special respect and honor that was given to Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. Mutawakkil Abbasi imposed a severe house arrest upon the 10th divinely appointed Imam. He monitored all his activities, he pinpointed his followers, and prevented legal dues from coming to Imam al-Hadi. He even tried his best